Session number 22369, reel 2.
General Buckland, reel 2.
I got to where they operated on me after about 3 weeks, and they found that the thing was still not healed enough for them to take it out. And two of the surgeons wanted to cut my leg off entirely, but the third one, thank God, who was a senior, said no. They operated again after 6 weeks, and then they took the bit out. And the surgeon said I'd have a stiff knee when by the time I was... ...45, but as you can see, I can bend it at 81 still.
This is your right leg.
Yeah. I was then sent home from the hospital after 8 weeks there, and spent my time in London with my family, going as an outpatient to have physiotherapy, etc., at the Royal Masonic Hospital. And bluffed my way back at the end of December by passing a board. I told them, which was not strictly true, that I'd been playing two rounds of golf every day, because they said that my leg still looked extremely swollen, which it was. But I knew perfectly well, being in armour, I hadn't got to walk very far, so that once I got back, it would be perfectly okay, because I had my own scout car. Anyhow, they passed me fit. But such was the bureaucracy that, as opposed to being allowed to fly back with a chum in the Royal Air Force, which I had fixed, I was ordered to go back to Purbright and wait there for 3 weeks and take a draft out, which I did, and joined the battalion not until February the 5th. No, February the 2nd, that's right. We then moved the same day as I arrived back at the battalion, which was at a place called Tilburg. We moved that night after dark with no lights, etc., up to Nijmegen, where we did reconnaissances for the advance into Germany. Which started on the 8th of February. And I think that that next month was the most bloody fighting of all the war that I saw. We were fighting against the cream of the German army, who obviously realized that as soon as they were thrown east of the Rhine, they wouldn't stand much chance after that. So it was a very tough 4 weeks.
Can you give any details about it, please?
Well, the first day, I remember the ground had been flooded by the Germans, who'd opened some floodgates, etc. I remember chucking tables, chairs, and God knows what into a quagmire in order to try to get the tanks to go through, and we got some through, but not all that large number. Another thing that comes to mind was, oh yes, the opening barrage was fired by 1,500 guns, which was far more than they had at El Alamein. And I think they fired over 1 million shells in 5 hours, including light anti-aircraft shells, etc. And the original batch of prisoners we took were completely quaking. I mean, they were shaking all over, and you couldn't get any sense out of them at all. The only thing to do was to give them a cup of tea and a cigarette and sit them down and allow them to cool down for an hour or two, because they were completely, I can only describe the word as pulverized, mentally.
So it was shell shock.
Yeah. I remember we got into Cleve after about 24 hours and rescuing some drink because the Canadians got in at the same time and they found a naffy depot there where they promptly wanted to loot the lot, you know, and we managed to rescue some and take it away and put it in a three-tonner. So we had some drink which we doled out to in the easy stages. Another memory I have is of one of my best friends who was called Rafe Tennyson Danecourt, who was the technical adjutant. A tank was blown up on a mine and he was trying to get it out of the minefield by backing it back on its own tracks. And it hit another mine, which it had obviously gone over before and not exploded, and that hit him. And he died of wounds. And we were very upset indeed by that. Perhaps I should say at this book, at this stage, before I forget, a word or two about casualties. A tank battalion is frightfully lucky in that it has these splendid tin boxes in which it goes around in. And so you're pretty safe from shell fire, in fact, mortar fire, unless it's a heavy shell. And therefore, tank battalion casualties are far lighter than infantry battalion casualties. I did some work on it after the war was over, and we had 100% officer casualties, 10 killed and 24 wounded, but only 30% the other rank. Whereas in an infantry battalion, like, say, the 5th Battalion, who was fighting for roughly the same amount of time, they had about 150% officer casualties and about 160% other rank casualties.
Why was there such a disparity between officer casualties and other rank casualties in the Coldstream?
Well, this was really because the officer leads. So if you're in the leading tank, you're likely to get hit, as it were, if anybody's going to get hit. More people were killed or wounded, I think, outside their tanks than inside, because they were busy doing recces or whatever. I mean, I was wounded twice, both times outside my tank. The second time I was trying to find my way through a town in Germany in the dark. And I noticed a sentry, German sentry, standing outside a gate. Unfortunately, I reacted faster than he did and ordered him to put up his hand and come over to my scout car and to climb on it. And while I was asking him the way, his chums inside the barracks fired at the scout car and hit the side of it. Unfortunately, it didn't hit me direct, but the splinters from the side of the scout car came up in my face. The only real lasting effect was happened about a year afterwards. All my teeth went bad, and my dentist said, yes, have you had a blow in the face? I said, yes. He said, well, that's it. The roots have gone. So I have a complete top set now of false teeth, which I hate. Anyhow, where was I? Yes. I shot the poor man because I was so scared, by mistake almost, you know, and one clenches up and I had my pistol pointing at him and he fell off the scout car. I presume the poor chap was dead. Went back to the as he went to the headquarters where they saw blood all over the place. Said, you're very badly wounded. I said, no, I'm not. I'm just very angry, that's all. So they cleaned me up. What was I talking about before? Oh, yes, the reason for more officer casualties. Because the officer has to do the dangerous things, I think. I mean, I think you'll find that officer casualties in the infantry battalions of the line are just as bad. I don't know about officer casualties in armor. because I haven't made a study of it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. So you were fighting in the Reichswehr?
Yeah, that's right, yes. Well, we flogged away with the rain coming down most of the time against these German parachutists. And eventually we cleared them off, and we then had about a fortnight's gap rest while they brought all the bridging equipment up, etc., for the Rhine crossing and planned for that. And we went over the Rhine on the 26th of March, which was about 48 hours after the initial crossing, as soon as they'd built the first class 40 bridge. And we joined up with the 17th US Airborne Div, who we supported for the drive to Munster, which was fun, where we drove day and night.
It was fun?
Well, I mean, it was... no war is fun, but it was more fun than in the past, because we had few casualties. And we were advancing the whole time, fast. I had, I think, in 7 nights, a total of 7 hours sleep. And that was about par for the course. The commanding officer was much less sort of flaked out at the end of the 7 days when we got to Munster than we young ones were. But we went to bed for 18 hours, I suppose, and woke up feeling fine. Well, he went to bed for 18 hours and woke up feeling ghastly. And I found that when I got older as a brigadier and doing exercises out in Germany, it took me much more time to recover after an exercise out there, aged 45, than it did aged 25. Well, then we had another rest for 2 or 3 days, and then did a long approach march right through to the Weser, and crossed the Weser in the middle of April sometime, and again pressed on fairly smartly, except for one very stubborn battle near a place called Ramblingen, where they had some Hitler youth people there. And we were very angry with the infantry, who failed to get up in the dark and support one of the tanks which was hit. And so the crew were shot while they were trying to get out of it, including an officer from the Scots Guards who'd been loaned to us. We were very sad about that. Very nice boy indeed. The next thing I remember was going into a place called Silla, where I discovered a mini concentration camp in the sort of town, a little sort of piece of parkland where they'd built two huts with 20 people in each wearing these terrible striped pajamas. And there were Frenchmen and Poles and mixture. And one of them waved his skull at me doing this, because they'd somehow scalped him. Another one showed me a thumb which had been screwed off. So I was pretty angry with all this, and I ordered the burgomaster of the town and the town council to come and clean the mess up and get the people to hospital.
What was the reaction of the burgomaster and others?
Well, they were rather upset at being ordered, but of course one wasn't going to do it, but one said, if you don't do as you're told, you'll be shot at once. As they were accustomed to being told things like that. I remember there was an SS sergeant major who we took prisoner towards the end of the war somewhere, and we had him in a cage. And I gave instructions that they were to take exercise. Obviously, I mean, you know, we didn't want them just to sit down and do nothing, so they had to take some exercise. And this chap began running as hard as he could round the camp. And when he could no longer run, he walked, and then he crawled, and I was fascinated. And I said to some German, what's this damn fool doing? He said, well, you told him to take exercise, and that, in our outfit, means that once he's stopped taking exercise, he'll be shot. God, honestly, how pathetic can you be? But I then went and said, well, what do you think you're doing? Oh, and he said, so I said, well, just calm down. You aren't going to be shot. You're an SS man. You'll be taken off to as you went to prison. You probably knew this, didn't you? But because where the SS were very stupid was they had tattooed near the fork here, lightning sign. So you made everybody drop their trousers and lift their shirts up, and you and you SS over there, rest you over there. Skipping the story a bit, after the war was over, we got, or we acted as a sort of transit camp among lots of other units for moving German units to a great area in the northeast of Schleswig-Holstein, where they were all put into approximately 2 million of them. Where they were all, of course, looked after by experts who weeded out the farmers at once and sent them back to get on with farming, because the whole place had no crops and no nothing, starving. So we wanted to get the farmers back. And the SS, of course, were all put on one side and locked up. I've skipped out a bit. After Ramblingen, we had a three-day battle for a place called Ulsen, which was a very tough fight, again with 15 Scottish. And that was the final sort of big battle until we got up to the Elbe. We then paused.
Describe anything about
Ulsen. Well, it was a typical sort of town, and one had to clear it street by street, house by house. You've probably heard of the phrase mouse holing, haven't you?
Where
you
mouse hunt?
Mouse holing.
Mouse holing, no.
Where you knock holes in walls and climb through them in order to get at the next room, etc. So we in our tanks were supporting the infantry who were doing this. And that's why it took 3 days to clear the place. I don't think I can describe much more about it, other than, as I say, it was fairly heavy hand-to-hand, close-quarter fighting, which the infantry obviously had to take the brunt of. We then crossed the River Elbe on the 30th of April, and the Germans had a long-range gun, which they discovered where our bridge was, and started to put some shells down. Unfortunately, they didn't hit the thing. But I was only too pleased to move closer to the enemy as opposed to sitting next door to the bridge. On the 4th of May, when we were skirmishing sort of near Hamburg, to the east of Hamburg, a carload of senior German officers came up with a white flag, and we passed them through. And they were the first lot of people who were coming to a surrender. And 2 days later, on the 6th of May, I think it was, some more senior people came through us and were taken down to Monty's headquarters and down to Reims, where Eisenhower was, where they signed the peace thing, the armistice. We were ordered to go up to Kiel because the German Navy had not surrendered. And they weren't intending to surrender, I don't think, if they could avoid it. So we were ordered to take our tanks to Kiel and drive through Kiel, take over the German naval headquarters in Kiel, and make quite sure that the German Navy was not obstreperous. Mind you, they hadn't got anything to fight with by then, except for their U-boats, because the surface fleet had just about been completely destroyed. We found in Kiel Harbour the Hipper, which was a large cruiser which was sunk. When I say sunk, I mean it had been bombed and hit and just sunk down at the quayside. There were one or two destroyers, I think, which were still working. And they broke out and sailed somewhere else. I don't know what happened to them.
So do I understand that throughout the Second World War you served in the capacity all the time as intelligence officer with the 4th Coldstream Guards?
Not entirely. I did, when I joined the 4th Battalion, I did 6 months in No. 3 Company. And then in order to train up a replacement for me, because the commanding officer obviously wanted to have a spare, I went back to No. 3 Company for about 3 months between November 43 and February 44. Went back to being intelligence officer again in about the 1st of March 44. I should say that when the war was over and we'd done our job of rounding up all the Germans, and there was one very interesting evening where a very smart group of men came marching down the road with a tall, upstanding officer in front of them. And he saw our brigade sign on our arms. And he said, "May I please speak to my men?" And I said, "What do you want to talk to them about?" He said, "I want to tell them that we are proud and privileged to be passing through the 6th British Guards Panzer Brigade, whom we have fought against so often and whom we admired so much." And he gave them a pep talk. And they left that field the following day in apple pie order among them. I mean, all the tin cans and the biscuit packets and all that had been cleaned up perfectly. Where some of the other outfits who we passed through, they left the place just like a sort of, well, like a gypsy camp almost. But after the war was over, of course, we decided we'd go back to being infantry. So we handed in our armor and had a farewell to armor parade at a place called Rotenburg, and moved down to the western end of Germany again, by which time I was then appointed to command No. 3 Company because people were starting to be demobilized, of course, and so the senior ones went out and we moved up. And I spent an interesting 6 months, 9 months, on the frontier west of Aachen, which was the main route to and from Belgium into Germany. And we had a customs post with some Allied military government people who were customs officers with us. And one made the most extraordinary hauls of loot from people who were trying to, I mean, they were smuggling into Germany coffee, and they do it by sewing two pairs of pants together and putting the coffee beans in between the two pairs of pants. So you made everybody get out of their cars or whatever, and if their hips stuck out a mile, you made them go inside the hut and strip off. You found these pants full of coffee beans. And I remember once we caught a chap, an Armenian, I think he was, who was smuggling carpets out of Germany. Where he brought them from, I don't know, which he was obviously going to flog in Belgium. And he had 140 carpets covered over with straw, etc., which we discovered and pulled them all out. And the customs and excise people took them all off, and I suppose what they did was to dispose of them. I don't know. We then moved back to the north of Germany again in April 45. No, 46 now, that's right, April 46. And my company was stationed not at Eckernförde, which is where the rest of the battalion was, but near a German prison called Rendsburg. And I had two very unpleasant tasks to do there. One was to shoot two Poles, the firing squad, at dawn, who had been convicted of breaking into a warehouse and killing the night watchman. And I asked if I might be allowed to have two firing squads, because they were shot at half-hour intervals. And they said, no, we'll make do with one. Well, the first one was all right, because the soldiers didn't really know what was going to happen. It all sounds very sort of, smart to be shot, but I can assure you it isn't at all. It's a very nasty thing to do because it takes so long. By the time the poor chap has been got out of the Black Marat, taken up to the stake with a bag over his head, tied to the stake, a disc pinned onto his thing, onto his heart, the priest has given the last rites, and you've got everybody back behind the firing point, and you've then got your soldiers to take up their rifles. And you have taken them away while you substitute two blank rounds for two live rounds in the eight people that are shooting. So until they actually pull the trigger, they don't know if they've got a live round up the spout or not. What this proves, I'm not quite sure, but you know afterwards if you haven't shot him, but if you have had a live round, obviously you have. The first one worked excellently, but the second one, and the soldiers by then were not in the best mood, and although I was assured by the doctor that the chap wouldn't have felt anything because we'd hit him enough times, he was obviously moving about, and so the provost marshal had to dash up and put a round through his head, which I think was a pity. The other thing I had to do, which was very interesting, was I had to go to Hamelin because I was the mandatory witness for two more Poles who'd been convicted of murder, to watch Mr. Pierpoint hanging them. And Pierpoint was a very interesting man, I thought. If you want a nice, quick death, that is the way to go, because I timed the second one, and from the time that he started his work to the time that he pulled the trap was 11 seconds. So you don't have much time to think about it, whereas the shooting took about 4 minutes. As I say, from the time you come out of the Black Marat, taken up, etc. Well, then, the order came through for the battalion to be disbanded, and so we went home to England in July 46 and were disbanded at Pirbright.
Now, I think you were in Palestine. Can you give an account of what happened to you there, please?
Yes, I was by then adjutant of the 1st Battalion, which I took over in the autumn of 47, and was allowed to stay behind because we sent companies out one at a time each month by troop ship to replace the 3rd Battalion, which had been out there since the end of the war almost. And I came out with the final draft because those of us who were taking the Staff College exam had been allowed to stay behind and do it. And we arrived in Haifa on, I think, about St. George's Day, April the 23rd, and the second command was told that he was to take command of the battalion because the commanding officer had been wounded, because we just missed a three-day battle between the Jews and the Arabs for the city of Haifa, which the Jews won. And our commanding officer was trying to sort things out and got shot in the arm, in the elbow, and so had to go home. But Palestine, you really had to be on your toes. We had, I suppose, about 18 sentry posts all round the camp. The main gate, you had two barriers, not one. And woe betide anybody who allowed both barriers to be up at the same time. You had covering these two barriers, not only the sentries who were the fall guys, as it were, who were checking people in and out, but covering the sentries, you had a thing called a projector infantry anti-tank built into a sandbag emplacement, and a machine gun built into another emplacement. So they were two separate